Thank you very, very much. That was, you know, I couldn't imagine a better series of connections. And in a sense, it's continuing a conversation that, as Michael said, that we initiated a year ago, with the idea of this. One of my obsessions, if I could lie on the couch there, we'd get to the bottom of it, is with these images of eternity in orbital motorways, orbital railways. And maybe, because I've already passed this barrier that Michael is celebrating today, and everything beyond that is a kind of bonus. You get a bit light-headed, and the images that are there are almost the living cartoons that superimpose over us as we think. The idea of this railway as being this transit between stages of a life became very potent for me, particularly through the figure I think I talked about last time of the painter Leon Kossoff, who is absolutely the identity of a certain kind of vision of London. The Jewish emigrant who's placed in Whitechapel, grows up around a circuit, which is Arnold Circus, where his father has a bakery, and he walks around it as a child, and he looks up at the enormous phallic mass of Nicholas Hawksmoor's Christchurch Cathedral, and starts to do drawings of that as a child, and then returns to it, and travels down the railway, stage by stage by stage, till he arrives at Willesden Junction, where he has a studio on the railway, and he paints enormous sweeping vistas of these railways, and remembers himself as a child being sent out of London into the country by railway and looking at the country through that. So the kind of railway as a form of reverie, or almost a sort of psychoanalytical moment, was perfect for talking here, and that's what we talked about last time. This time it's really nice to pick up the conversation a stage further, with Ian Wilkinson's image staring at us. And more than that, as we're in the shop there outside, I was talking to Ian, and he looked round the wall, and he had made all the prints that you'll see around the wall there, because he's actually, in day-to-day life, a very fine printmaker. And that's where our connection came. But I can't start without really going back to this connection with this particular house, with the nature of Freud's very brief exile in London, and how that impinges on all our lives. Because I came to London myself, first of all, in the early 60s, and it's a place that I don't think of as London anymore. It was in Brixton. I was on the other side of the river. It felt like a different kind of city. And the only way I recognized London was a spine. It was a sort of Northern Line spine that carried you up Charing Cross Road and all the second-hand bookshops, Tottenham Court Road, up into Camden, the Roundhouse, and then you were into the foothills of what was then anti-psychiatry, the kind of bastard offspring of Freud. R.D. Lang and David Cooper were all enmeshed and colonizing this landscape. You could feel the buzz and thrust of the arguments they were bringing in at that time. And then at the top of the hill, crowned by the Everyman Hampstead, the cinema where they used to, in repertory, have an endless flow of Ingmar Bergman's cheerful Swedish forms of demonic psychoanalysis, which I used to come up from Brixton up there, see them all. And then I finally, after a lot of years being in Dublin, settled in London in 1967, and actually got the very brief privilege of living up here in a little room for £4 a week in Rudel Crescent. So I'm here. And at that point, I stumbled by accident on everything that would inform everything else I did in London after that, which was this idea of a kind of strange derive. Someone was coming over from America, someone was coming over from Dublin, and I decided we would have to undertake this walk. I didn't know where it would go. I stumbled on the idea of the walk as a dream and as a way of leading you into whatever was going next. And where this walk had to start was in Golders Green crematorium where Freud's ashes were. That was my very first move. So there to go, Freud's ashes. We come down to Highgate. We'll Karl Marx's head, a like a kind of great chess piece, dropped down a bit below to where Rambo and Verlaine lived in Royal College Street, and we'll just see where that leads us. Well, where in fact it led us was a place I'd never heard of or been to, which is called Hackney. But following the canal after that, we drifted through a kind of landscape that was half forbidden and emerged in Victoria Park in Hackney. So essentially my life was set by that connection with Freud's ashes. So I'll just read you from this book a little fragment about that, because it was so significant and accidental. My own and only engagement with place was through mapping and walking. No sooner was I settled in my Hampstead room in 1966 than travelling to a part-time job force-feeding general studies to motor mechanics in Walthamstow, then I plotted an excursion as a method of linking figures who struck me as binding the territory together, contributing their underlying and still unexposed London mythology. I roped in a couple of companions, floaters from Dublin, and led them to Golders Green Crematorium, where we paid our respects to Freud's ashes. All that heat and smoke reduced to an ornamental urn. Between mourners, we processed the paved walkways, the Italianate colonnades, failing to acknowledge the traces of other London figures cremated here. All those already recorded, installed on commemorative tablets, or those still to come, slots reserved for a future date. Anna Freud, Doris Lessing from Finchley in West Hampstead, the architect Erno Goldfinger and his brutalist towers, the twin spectres of Westway and the Blackwall Tunnel approach, the concrete obelisks for a city that never happened, and Joe Orton, butchered in Islington, and Bram Stoker, banishing Count Dracula to Purfleet. But our biggest miss of all was Percy Wyndham Lewis, whose trilogy, The Childermas, Monster Guy, and Malign Fiesta, was the most accurate topographical chart that I knew of the soul's attempt to penetrate the labyrinth of the Golden City. Some homing solitary shadow, continually arriving in the restless dust of the turnpike, Lewis wrote, prefiguring past and future pilgrims, from John Bunyan to John Clare, the almost living in pursuit of the not quite dead. Well, what I didn't do at that time, and I don't know if it was available to do it, was to come to Maresfield Gardens. I mean, I knew this connection, the last years of Freud's life, and the idea of the garden, and the idea of that astonishing study, the accumulations of that study, the weight of stuff on the desk, the idea of people like the poet H.D. Lying there. I don't know if she did lie there, actually. Did she? No.
But she might have come here in 1938.
She might have come here, but yeah. Virginia Woolf came here to socialise with Freud. Mm. I mean, the idea of these personages and the saturation that went into all the books in that library, the kind of weight of stuff, became part of London. And when I was here before, I talked about the mythologies of Sherlock Holmes and Sigmund Freud, both essentially detectives of the city, unpicking and decoding the city and how it works, and how now essentially they're equals. They're both London immortals. One actually lived, one was a projection, but nevertheless they were here. And I look at the books in Anna Freud's room upstairs, and on her little bookshelf is The Mystery of Edwin Drood, this unfinished opium dream of Charles Dickens that seems to fit exactly with this. So those things were there. And the thing that struck me when I did finally come to visit Maresfield Gardens was a monitor screen on which there were an astonishing image of Lucian Freud and Sigmund Freud together. Lucian as a young boy in kind of cricket flannels and blazer or whatever, walking across the garden with his grandfather. And just a loop of that, and the loop of a late party that happened here when I think Freud was pretty ill. And then these images are imprinted over the place. And I began to think about images and death, and to be well aware that Freud was not comfortable later in life with the making of images. And Michael was telling me while we were talking outside that this was not something in his earlier life. He was quite prescient, you know, in using the image as a brand. Certain images of him could be distributed for various reasons, but at the late stage, no. And I just touch on that briefly, because it's our own way of entering the universal stream of mortality, contemplating our mortality through the study of images. Much of the bleached out garden footage, looped within twinned monitors, lobes of memory, these are the ones here, reminded me very much of my own dreams of a childhood assembled from surviving 16mm home movies. My memories are of the films, not of the events behind them, the parties, the weddings, and the dead faces laughing. Those who acknowledge the cameras and those who learn to ignore its nuisance. My mother before I was born, and then again my father's father, the medical grandfather I never knew, holding up cake for his dog to jump. The doctor was not well. He wears a hat, and he looks like the established James Joyce, convalescent after the latest eye operation, or like Freud in Maresfield Gardens. He's got a border collie, a bringer of messages from the other side. The conscious wears away. The unconscious is unchanging. Freud disliked cameras, a mechanical system of evaluating the past to rival his own, and he never tolerated rivals. Whenever in the secure reservation, the Arcadia of Maresfield Gardens, confrontation became inevitable, a consequence of his fame or notoriety, he submitted, putting on a face as stern as a Greek tragic mask. He refused the Czech-born director Pabst, who requested permission to contrive a film around the person of the Viennese analyst. Freud could have entered our European art cinema pantheon alongside Greta Garbo and Louise Brooks. Pabst, by 1930, had evolved a style acclaimed for its psychological prescience. He had what they called an X-ray eye camera style, seeing through flesh and fabric. His London, designed in Pandora's box for Louise Brooks as a victim of Jack the Ripper, was a studio set in Berlin. Analysis, Freud told Pabst, does not lend itself to any kind of camera. So we're moving closer on Palermo, but my beginnings in London, actually beginning to try and write about London after the period of that war, when I was a gardener in Limehouse, started with a quote from W.B. Yeats, which I used in the book of that time, which was, "The living can assist the imagination of the dead." And that became my code, really, for doing everything in London. The idea that we're moving across London all the time, absorbing these voices and presences that have been here before us, and somehow working as their assistants. We're our assistants to the kind of the universal dead, that they form some great spirit of the city. The city becomes unified through these figures, and later people who struggle about in some way are only responding to that, in the way that these photographs respond to the extraordinary presence of these catacombs in Palermo. And I thought then of a series of other remarks about the dead that would act as my guide. Freud himself, with a Latin tag named Moriari Mori, to prevent death by dying. And Beckett saying, "Each breath nearer the last, the dead die hard. They are the trespassers on the beyond." And the novelist Rodrigo Frezan, who wrote a London novel called Kensington Gardens, which pretended to a tremendous experience of London and then confessed later that he wrote it all in a hotel by Heathrow, never went into London, just absorbed a whole lot of books, including mine, and came up with this: "The dead become the fictions of those who survive them. We subject them to the indecency of deletions, additions, and revisions, and we end up rewriting that other zone." Well, the trip to Palermo and this confrontation was exactly about that. It was about rewriting that other zone. I got a message from a man called Mike Goldmark, who has a gallery in Uppingham. And I tended to that because I owed him, you know, a big favor in the sense that way back in the 80s, I'd been living as a second-hand book dealer, and he had a little shop in Uppingham, and I used to go in there all the time, and he had a great gift for drawing you out and seeing what you were really doing. And he found out I had a small press, and I published books, and he got them. He never read them. You know, he sort of had them on the shelf. I said, "Have you ever read one?" He said, "No." Fine. So I had the idea that I would like to write this London novel called Whitechapel Scarlet Tracings, and I had this way back. And so he said to me, "If you ever write this book, I will print it, because I really want to become a publisher. I have the idea for particularly beautiful looking books that will always have nice images, be beautifully set up, and this book sounds right for that." So years and years later, finally, I turned up on his doorstep. I said, "I've written the book." He said, "Okay, I'll do it. Don't you want to read it first?" "No." So, okay, fine. He goes off to Verona, and he gets a man called Marderstyke, great typographer, lays out the book. The book is done. So when he says he wants to, he's in the city, and his daughter is giving a recital in the city church, it felt absolutely right. So I dropped whatever I was doing. I went down to the city. We saw the rehearsal. And at the end of it, he said to me, I've got something I'd like to talk to you about. I think you might be kind of interested." So, okay. And what it was that Ian Wilkinson, who works with him as a printmaker, had obsessively been visiting Palermo with Jan for a number of years and making a series of images, very extraordinary images, of the catacombs. So I went up to Uppingham, and I was confronted with these. They are massive. They're massive. And the thing is, the difficulty is that obviously the images themselves come with an enormous sense of narrative. That there are these sort of grotesque memento mori figures who are vertical, and Ian has put with them to make a kind of tension, series of small birds interact. And these birds come from Leicestershire. So I talked to him, and he tells me he's walking across these kind of anonymous fields in Leicestershire, comes across a ruined building that has a large fireplace or chimney stuffed with these dead birds, little skeletal birds. And he fills up these bags with birds and comes back and somehow combines the birds and the figures in the catacombs. And so I go to Palermo, and suddenly it's as if, you know, I'm initially going to write a sort of a little 10-page response, essay, compliment to the book of photographs. And after I stand up from my desk, I realize I've written 65 pages. And it's only marginally about the actual images themselves, but it's become one of those things like Freud in Palermo. The world seems to be waiting in Palermo in a weird parallel to Mayersfield Gardens that seemed to be everything I was involved with at that time. I was very involved with a book called The Vor by a friend of mine, Brian Catling, who is a performance artist. He's performed here. He actually did a performance when he appeared to eat one of the figures from Freud's desk. He's a poet and a professor in Oxford in the Ruskin School of Fine Art. But he'd suddenly had a kind of seizure and erupted and written these 10 enormous fictional books, one of which is The Vor, the first one of a series. And that one includes a lot of fascination and begins, in fact, with the figure of Raymond Roussel, who checks into the Grand Hotel in the center of Palermo and commit suicide. Raymond Roussel is an eccentric, very wealthy French poet, a kind of a proto-surrealist, who is deeply interested in image making but doesn't like to take photographs himself. He sort of becomes a subject of photographs, and who is also very interested in ideas of death and images. So I'm very interested in him being in that hotel. I'm very interested in Brian Catling drawing on that, because earlier I knew that he'd gone to Palermo to make an installation piece about the catacombs. and he'd gone with filmmaker Tony Grizzoni. And I asked him about that, and they went to the catacombs. They were amazed by the catacombs, as everyone is. And Tony Grizzoni, a very well-known filmmaker and scriptwriter now, made a series of extreme close-up images of all of these figures. And Brian was supposed to come up with a complimentary text. So he was in the same position as me. And he couldn't do it. You know, something about those figures struck him dumb. He just... And quite by accident, the camera had picked up voices from elsewhere, because these catacombs are quite shallow. They're not deep within the bowels of the earth. And you hear the voices from a little cemetery, a garden cemetery like this that's up above, and they drift down. So essentially, the installation they made were the images, and it seemed that the voices were the voices of the living ventriloquizing the figures of the dead in the same city. And it worked as a piece, but it couldn't do what they wanted to do. And then another photographer I've worked with, who actually comes from Palermo, called Mimi Malika, who's come from Palermo to Hackney, was very interested in a Sicilian community up on the Lee Valley. Way up the Lee Valley, the Sicilian kind of mafia took over the cucumber trade. And Mimi Malika made a series of beautiful photographs of this community, who carry on the Sicilian way of life in Essex. They have tables spread out, dancing, they have religious processions down by the River Lee, the whole bit, and he did that. And he went back to Palermo to make a series of photographs, and they were of the people on the streets above. And he started to photograph the kind of mafia foot soldiers, big, fat guys, you know, really powerful men, drinking at tables, laughing and talking loudly, loudly, as if somehow to counterbalance the skeletal presence of these figures below. So there was a beautiful thing there, but again, it was impossible, for various reasons, to carry out the photographs. When you get to the Capuchin monastery, which is sort of on the, what would have once have been towards the outer edges of the town, come in and it's €2 to go in, which is very reasonable. And when I went in December, there's nobody there, completely on my own. It's €200 if you want to take a photograph. So it's an amazing distinction between the idea of making an image and just walking through. I didn't want to take a photograph. The last thing in the world I wanted to do was take a photograph. And I was thinking about the series of images I'd seen by Ian Wilkinson. When I gave myself up to the index of these necrophile prints, I began to see them as a book of secular saints existing outside theology and outside time. The mummy shells had not been sanctified for miracles performed during their earthly life. They were conduits for future miracles. They were oracular and blasphemous. They were mute, but they were talking in bird code. The crow, Robert Graves tells us in The White Goddess, was a bird much consulted. Graves associates the crow with Bran, the crow god. But crow, raven, scald crow, and other large black carrion birds are not always differentiated in early times. Crows have picked out the eyes of the witnessing dead, making husks into a kind of cloaks they used to use to cover cameras. The Capuchin mummies are not there to be inspected by congeries of awed and shuffling tourists. They are recording instruments. They are sucking up breath. They are glistening with borrowed sweat. They are avid for language. The hung mummies are also cameras, and they are looking right back at the thing that is looking at them. With the discovery of a labyrinth of underground burials in Rome in 1578, mountains of early Christian bones were disinterred, bones that could be an insanitary nuisance or a resource. The mercantile wing of the Catholic Church, with its well-honed predatory instincts, its relic franchise, its branding operations, its hierarchic travel bureau for a guaranteed safe passage to the next world, business class to heaven, recognized a golden opportunity. German churches and religious houses needed a USP, a cash magnet attraction for pilgrims. They needed miracle-working arrangements of set-dressed bones, and there were plenty on offer in Italy. Decorated in gold thread and pearls, nun-worked lace and fan cambric, spattered with emeralds and rubies, these manufactured replacements for the idolatrous effigies destroyed during the Protestant Reformation were known as catacomb saints. Certificates of authenticity were purchased, and Protestant carriers had no qualms for a price about transporting the bone bags across the Alps. The new beings emerged from the slumber of the catacomb shells into a light of display in cathedrals and restored churches. Veiled with lips rouged and wigged in silvery strands, the bone saints were rescued from the dignity of death and paraded in travesty. Their invented biographies were surrealist hypothesis for a theme park theology. Now I understood something of the nature of the instinctive processes of Ian Wilkinson's Palermo Prince, and something too of my own part in this enterprise. The skeleton could settle into its new role of patron and protector of the community. So something really, really strange happened here. Quite by accident, the Capuchin monks had been dropping their dead into a kind of a cellar. And atmospheric conditions and the pipes and whatever preserved these bodies so strangely that they decided this was a sort of miracle. And they eventually settled on making a kind of exhibit or museum of the standing dead. And this is the thing, that the dead that I was talking about in terms of London, the one that the living can assist the imagination of the dead, is very dependent on the dead being horizontal, or the dead being ash and released. That when you go around these oases of London, like Highgate Cemetery, or Bunhill Fields, or Abney Park, all of the places we go to meditate that are overgrown and wild and return to nature, the dead that are there, their stones are horizontal, or some part of their history is there, generally just words that are fading and that dissolve with time, and somehow you're communicating with these resting, sleeping, reverie-like spirits. In this situation, it's quite the reverse. That's what's discomforting is that they're standing and they're confronting you. And as you go down there, it's a quadrangle. There are the monks, and then they're by occupation. There's a whole bunch of doctors, whole bunch of lawyers, all of the wealthy and respectable who bought themselves space in there and now being preserved by processes like the kind of Egyptian processes of mummification, kind of things that did fascinate Freud in some ways, this limbo. The final figure from the 1920s, I think, is of a child, a young girl, completely dressed up. And that's really, really disturbing. And there are alcoves of children, and so on. So you move around this. And the clothes are also disturbing because the clothes are in a different kind of time. The clothes are of their time. They're rotting away, or they're greasy, they're stained, and then bits of straw are coming out of these figures. But the figures still have presence. They have individual presence, and they have a communal presence. All of them there, the 2,000 or however figures that are around there. And the sense that Ian Wilkinson comes back year after year after year to attend to these there. And I think it's very fascinating, and I think it's probably right that Freud wouldn't have visited it. It would have been too much in lots of ways. And essentially, he didn't need to, but it has such a powerful Freudian context anyway. And alongside this, then you have this grand hotel of ghosts, place where Roussel came to. So Roussel is this eccentric poet who, because he's so wealthy, can produce whatever extraordinary books he wants, with Impressions of Africa and Locus Solus. And before he leaves Paris, the last sort of thing he does, he goes to Père Lachaise Cemetery, and he buys for himself a set of catacombs. So he's got his own private catacombs. He's going to be the only person in it. It's there, in Paris. He has a special vehicle that he's designed with sort of closed windows, like a kind of model of an early model of a camper van, that he can cross continents without any of the vulgarity of tourism. He doesn't actually look out at the landscape. He's sitting at his table writing. and occasionally people are taking photographs of him. And when he's in Palermo, he's driven around in this strange vehicle at night, down to the docks and so on, because he's got this gay agenda, and various characters are picked up, come back to the hotel. And these hotels, these grand hotels, have enormous mirrors, so he's endlessly contemplating the kind of otherness of the figure in the mirror, and eventually he does kill himself. But what's uncanny is that in his second major book, Locus Solus, he has this idea of a very wealthy man with an estate outside Paris who decides to animate the dead. You know, he's an inventor. He makes a series of strange inventions and has these tableaus like the catacombs, except that these figures are dead, but they are animated by forms of electricity, that they're able to carry out kind of primitive acts. And they seem to be in this freeze of somewhere between life and death. Roussel didn't need to inspect the detritus of the Capuchine catacombs. In his fiction, he had already invented methods for bringing the dead back, for reanimating shells of former human entities in a simulacrum of life. All of those monks on hooks in the subterranean cloakroom corridors are waiting to be scripted by a poet with Roussel's bizarre gifts and his available fortune. Roussel tested the language formulae to tap what Greville Lindop called the sleepless memory of the new dead. The memory ocean that is no longer individual but universal. Memory of plants, insects, stones, ancestors, stars, dust, sand. Death was advancing fast. It was waiting in the suite of a grand hotel. It was waiting in Palermo. The hand of death modelled him speedily and soon made his head a skull, Iris Murdoch wrote in The Black Prince. He did not try to write. Death was a release from the obligation to write, from the awful conviction of his own genius, his fate. When the young poet at the age of 17 is possessed or deluded by a fever of work, a fever of words, he sees rays of light streaming from pages he has defaced with images of crowds and factories. The terrible compositional tasks, Mark Ford wrote, seem to prefigure an unstoppable logorrhea. Equally prescient is the complaint that nobody will understand his writings. In Locus Solus, published in 1914, Roussel presents a scholar of private means who conducts a group of friends and acquaintances around the park of his beautiful villa at Montmorency. The park is gallery, museum, laboratory, and philosophical conceit. At the start of the First War, Roussel is bringing back the dead, twitched meat, soulless as zombies, hypnotized sleepwalkers in white bone masks. He succeeded. The illusion of life was absolute, mobility of expression, continual working of the lungs, speech, actions, walking. Nothing was missing, but it remained an illusion. Negatives printed into mechanistic performance by doses of a special chemical, resurrectiony. Roussel's iced stiffs are nudged towards a temporary status as freakish exhibits. The catacomb husks of Palermo, the generations of Capuchin friars wrapped in sheets and lowered into a pit, into a large cistern under the altar of St. Anne, are dried out and drained and stuffed with straw. From the mound of bones when excavations began in 1599, 45 corpses are found to be intact, heaped one on top of the other in a ghastly pyramid. The miracle demands some form of display, and so the rectangle of dim corridors is created. What somehow became the absolute challenge of this place was this battle between image-making and these things which were like images. And the thing I mentioned earlier is what you became aware of. Sound was extraordinary. You're walking over on it starts off with glass, a glass floor laid over old tiles. So you and it has a special sound. And if you're there on your own, you're very aware of this footfall, and you're very well aware that these figures absorb you in a really strange way. And it is absolutely as if they have become the camera presences drinking whatever you can bring to them to somehow keep them as a valid entity. It's very freakish, and it demands an otherness, which Ian Wilkinson has done by presenting these birds. So there's a kind of alphabet of birds, which is a very old druidic form, and they are arranged with the tableau of the figures who are down there in this kind of eternity. And there's a real dialogue that goes two ways. I talked about Brian Catling and Tony Grizzoni hearing eavesdropping in a way on the voices of the street, casual voices of the street, that become, the contemporary voice becomes part of these fixed figures. But it also goes the other way. So that when we went out at the end of this, to walk through the garden of the cemetery, which was quite a relief, you know, it was like being out in the open air, like walking out into this garden now, the presence of the figures below was heavy, was immense. And looking at the gravestones, you realize that what you wouldn't see in very much in a Church of England or a Protestant background is that the images, portraits, were imposed on a lot of the gravestones. A lot of the gravestones had very sophisticated images that were kind of done with backdrops of sea or mountain that had been almost studio portraits prepared for this eternity of being laminated onto a gravestone, so the image of your life is there. In a sense, that traps you and holds you in a particular moment of time, whereas in the old traditional the sort of English country churchyard cemetery, the wind and the weather and whatever gradually erases you, so you disappear from the story and you're gone. It seems like a natural process. The standing up is a frontier thing. In the American West, you know, in the earlier frontier days when people were there and death was quite a moment in the tiny community, they're very traditional to take the photographs of the people in vertical coffin. So that they were dressed exactly like these, fully in their best clothes, and a kind of portrait would be made that would try and hold the person in life in that wilderness, in the same way that often if notable bandits or Mexican cross-border bandits had turned up and were executed, they also would be photographed in these propped up vertical coffins, as if to be still standing somehow conferred a certain kind of status. I'll just finish with the sense of going through that place, kind of the dream of the place that takes in the idea of Roussel coming, almost arrowing himself into that place. I kind of feel almost in the wake of Freud. I think that would have played into him, and the idea of the concept of the Grand Hotel, the kind of final place, Palermo. As a site where all of the cultures mixed and mingled. There's this astonishing chapel that is a Norman creation, but draws on the East, draws on all of the cultures, and makes this kind of a multiple god, all gods combined in one site. It's a bit like that. There's a glass floor of a pattern of memorial stones, and I'm walking now in a strange way. It's more like skating or paddling through a shallow stream. I can't hear my footfall. The husks are pressed so closely together, a mute jewelry from the past absorbs sound. There's a division between the bone armatures, shrink-wrapped in tanned leather, and the clothes that cover them. Clothes age. Clothes have a date and a time. The husks are timeless. They're anaesthetized, they're waiting on judgment, their hands are roped. The challenge for me is a sense of being caught between these drained representations, these mummified Xeroxes of departed souls, and the reservoir of velvety prints that Ian Wilkinson has made for his catacomb theatre. His animating device is the introduction of English birds. Birds are the missing voices. Birds are plucking at the straw as the mummies come apart, abdicating their grisly parody of life. Wilkinson's eye focuses on texture, on fraying rope, embroidered silk, a rusting key. The roughness of bone as it turns to coral. Any hope of light takes the form of a white feather, floating, on an unsourced current of warm air, cobwebs, stitches, a wine stain of dead hair, beaks, wings like the exposed ribs of cat umbrellas. Making my way in a pose of assumed meditation around the rectangle, the enclosed cloister with its thick shadows, I can't begin to understand the courage or the recklessness it takes to make an image, to make a print of the curtain of things, the creatures who are all too obviously making a print of you. I think Brian Catling sensed this when he found himself unable to construct speeches for the rack of mummies. He refused to impose a narrative on beings who are all narrative, who are condemned to perform their own absence for centuries with no hope of remission. Photography is risk. Beyond the spoiled ghost of Roussel, mesmerized by his Grand Hotel mirror, Catling summons Edward Muybridge, the man who tried to break the stream of time into a legible sequence of single frames. Imprisoned within the complex currents of his book, The Vor, Muybridge is a hollow man. And we are the light that the dead drink. The sound that troubles their stop memory. Mr. Kurtz, he dead. We are the hollow men, we are the stuffed men, leaning together, headpieces filled with straw. Alas, our dried voices, when we whisper together, are quiet and meaningless as wind in dry grass or rat's feet over broken glass in our dry cellar. In 1925, T.S. Eliot anticipates the rustle of pantomime clothes racked in a Palermo dungeon, the sullen shapes supporting each other in the knowledge that if one goes, they all go, down in a tangled heap, turnips on a stick, back to the bone pyramid from which they were first articulated. Remember us, hollow men in dull Middle England fields, keeping off the birds, crowskin. Has Eliot paid a visit to this catacomb, to this dry cellar? Death and the camera. Death is a camera. Catling presents Muybridge, whose paint-smeared books of naked, forked acrobats and blind animals lay on the floor of Francis Bacon's Kensington studio, as a hollow bladder. He calls it a camera without an aperture. Passing alone down the avenue of grinning capuchin skulls and stuffed friars and uniformed corpses and mummies in mourning rags, I convince myself that these husks are cameras, hungry for whatever wafers of light I bring from the upper world. They suck, they absorb. The slender images of the passing visitors feed the synapses, creating false or borrowed memory cards. When the intruders depart, the skulls chatter like birds. Thank you. If anyone is interested in the project of the, which is called Our Late Familiars, which is this essay and Ian Wilkinson's photographs, Mike Goldmark is releasing a book quite shortly, and I think he's got prospectuses available in the shop next door, which you can look at. Okay, thank you.